Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today, we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations at the Point Lookout Conference Center in Northport for a talk by Anne Bernard, a New York Times journalist. The title of today's talk is Whither Syria and Where Is It Taking Us? Anne Bernard led coverage of the Syria war for 6 years as the New York Times Beirut Bureau Chief and has worked for the Middle East intermittently since 2003. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainpublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, president of Mid-Coast Forum.
I want to welcome people to the 424th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today, and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 36th year of covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. To listen to past forum presentations, to find out about upcoming forum programs, and to learn about how to become a forum member, visit our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we are very pleased to have with us Anne Bernard, who will be speaking on Whither Syria and Where Is It Taking Us? Anne Bernard, a New York Times journalist, led coverage of the Syria war for 6 years, reporting from across the Middle East as Beirut Bureau Chief. Since 9/11, she has chronicled the human and strategic impact of U.S. war policies on frontline areas from Iraq to Syria to the Gaza Strip. Ms. Bernard has worked from the Middle East intermittently since 2003, beginning as Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe in Baghdad, where she documented the American invasion and occupation of Iraq and its impact across the region. A proficient Russian speaker, Bernard began her career in journalism 25 years ago, reporting on the tumult of the post-Soviet era. She then covered local news for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Boston Globe. After 9/11, she was dispatched to New York, then to Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and beyond. She joined the New York Times Metro Desk in 2007 and moved back to the Middle East in 2012. Ms. Bernard has won several journalism prizes, including the Columbia Journalism School's Meyer Burger Award for a series of articles on the impact of the 2010 earthquake on New York's Haitian diaspora. She has been awarded a Pew Fellowship in International Journalism at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Ochberg Fellowship from the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University. Ms. Bernard recently rejoined the Metro section of the New York Times to cover issues on the environment and the impact of climate change. Another easy topic. And a warm welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you very much, George, and thank you, Matt, for inviting us up here. It's been a real pleasure. And for hiring us both at the Boston Globe so that we could meet and get married. and really, thank you all for coming. It's really exciting for me to see such a big audience, more than 100, maybe almost 200 people, for any talk that has Syria in the headline. Because there is a conventional wisdom out there that nobody cares, that Syria is too much for people to compute, that whatever happens, it's time just to start ignoring it and move on to the next big story. And I routinely see at events of mine and others who work on Syria that the public is actually still quite thirsty to understand more about what's happening there and in the rest of the Middle East and in the world, and what does it have to do with us in America. So, thank you very much. I hope to be able to answer some of those questions in regards to Syria. Well, You probably have heard ad infinitum all the statistics about Syria and the magnitude of what has gone wrong in that conflict. I'll just run over them again because they never sort of lose their edge. It's a country of 23, 24 million. It was a middle-income country, one of the countries in the Middle East that had the best literacy rates and a decent industrial base and high rates of college education. It had its problems. It had growing inequality, which is one of the things that sparked the revolt in 2011. It had also one of the most repressive governments in the region. And that kind of combination was perhaps not something that was going to be stable in the long run. But people were used to a certain amount of normalcy in their day-to-day life if they were lucky enough to not be affected by any of the very pervasive actions of the government. So now we have 6 million refugees outside the country, another 7 million people displaced inside the country. So that amounts to one half the population that has been driven from their homes by the war, many of them moving multiple times as time goes on. There are conservatively estimated to be 500,000 people killed in what's now more than 8 years of conflict. And large sections of many major cities in ruins. The currency collapsed, inflation rampant, and something that I just recently published a years-long investigation about is the vast expansion of the brutal system of torture prisons run by Syria's secret police. Those have existed for decades under Bashar al-Assad and his father, Hafez, but they were supersized during this conflict. They were a critical tool leading to the, we can call it a victory in a way for Assad today. They were a decisive tool for suppressing what began as a civil uprising seeking a marginal improvement in people's living standard and a marginal improvement in the amount of say they had over their own lives and their dignity as citizens. There are still at least 127,000 people missing inside this system. And that is most likely an undercount. That is many times more, but by a factor of at least 10, the number of people disappeared by ISIS in Syria, although ISIS has had much greater media attention because it plugs into the story of terrorism and Islamist extremism that captures a lot of attention, and I sometimes argue a disproportionate amount of our attention in the scope of things in the world. That means even if we take the conservative number of more than 100,000 people who have gone into those prisons and never come out, and that means we don't know if they're alive or dead, and the conditions in the prisons by themselves, even if you ignore the physical torture, the conditions in which people are kept, the lack of medical care, the lack of food, the crowding, the unsanitary conditions, amount to what the UN has called the crime against humanity of extermination. You can basically expect people to die simply from the conditions in these prisons. Then on top of that, there is torture of an extremely sadistic nature happening to people routinely. Now, I would estimate that hundreds of thousands of people have been through this system for short or long periods of time and have then made it out, and many have then left the country or have gone completely quiet trying to keep their heads down. And when you add those 127,000 missing, they have millions of relatives, because Syrians have large families that are very interconnected. So what kind of stability, what kind of future does a country have when, I'm not even talking about the indiscriminate bombing, the barrel bombs, the bombings from warplanes and helicopters and artillery shellings of neighborhoods. That's just by the government, not to mention atrocities committed by ISIS and others. But the government is by far the largest perpetrator because it's the one that has the levers of state power. has the full levers of the military and allies like Iran and Russia and air power behind it. Now that Assad has reasserted control over the country, part of the deal is that those traumas are not to even be spoken about. What happened after 1982, when a much smaller scale rebellion was put down with very similar methods, is that it was forbidden to talk about the prisons and the killings and the massacres. And that repression, both psychological and political repression of that trauma, is one of the seeds of the uprising that happened in 2011. So now we're talking about all these things having happened on a much larger scale, and again, to try to put it back in the box. And to me, this is not a recipe for stability in the long run in this country that, when you look at the map, it looks like a keystone in the middle of Europe, Asia, and Africa. So what happens to people that are still inside Syria? The institutions, always a bit rickety, now are, and then really in Syria was run more like by the mafia of one family. There are people that have official positions, but the real power lies with a very small inner circle. But those institutions, such as they were, are even more rickety than they were before. Iran and Russia are very deeply penetrated into the country, so that the sovereignty in whose name Assad said he was working has also been undermined. As I said, there's very little chance of reforms. Assad himself talks about how the country is better off today because it's more homogeneous. Our social fabric is more cohesive than it was before. He says this with a smile. I've heard him say this in person. And it's quite ominous because it means that we're pretty happy that we got rid of these people who believed in civil society, the human rights lawyers, the university students, the sectors of society that wholesale ended up leaving the country. And he's also, of course, talking about working class Sunnis who en masse were the backbone of the revolution. Not all of them, because if they had all supported the revolution, he wouldn't have been able to hang on as much as he has. But he's happy to have those 5 million people gone. And creepily, I heard this in 2013 when the number of refugees was much smaller. I don't remember what it was then. But there was a supporter of the Assads who worked in decoration. He had worked on Hafez al-Assad's palace. He ran a family, a business of craftspeople. And he said if Hafez had been around, he would have ended this revolt much sooner, even if he would have killed 5 million people. And I said, well, are you saying that as a figure of speech? He said, no, I think 5 million would be the number. And he should have done it. So I don't know if 5 million is a magic number, but they have got rid of at least 5 million people who are now outside the country with little hope of coming back. So how did we get here? So I want to come back to what I said at the beginning. There's a refrain that says, Syria is really complicated. You know, we can't really deal with it. And there's another refrain that says, it's very simple. The problem is those people over there, Muslims, Arabs, brown people over there, the other, they're really violent. They kill each other. Like, we shouldn't mess with that. But I'm here to complicate those concepts. Syria is not that complicated at its root. What happened is people from a wide variety of demographic backgrounds, economically, in terms of sect, everything, rose up inspired by the Arab revolts across the region, inspired by American, at least rhetorical, support for those revolts, asking for modest improvements to their political and economic status. They were met with maximum violence by a state which used the name of sovereignty and non-intervention and anti-imperialism to crush what was a grassroots movement, and did that on purpose, wanted to turn the conflict into one where it could claim that it was fighting terrorism. They did everything they could do to make that true. We, as the United States, opened the door for them very wide on that score. Since the beginning of the so-called war on terror, I remember writing the story for the print extra for the Boston Globe on 9/11, watching TV and writing the words. Since then, not that these prejudices and oversimplifications didn't exist before, but since then, the US has been one of the main powers and entities propagating the idea that really, at bottom, anything you do in the name of fighting terrorism can be justified. Torture, droning of people where you're going to get a very high ratio of civilians killed to suspects killed, killing American citizens without due process, and supporting our allies in doing the same. So we've helped create the fertile ground that Assad then supercharged by first releasing jihadis who were in his prisons. Why were they in his prisons? Because he had sponsored them to go to Iraq to fight the Americans. He wanted them out of Syria, go use them in America for his interests. Then when they came back, he put them right in prison, and he released them under what was supposed to be a concession to the revolution. But actually, while he was releasing those hardcore Islamist jihadis, he was vacuuming up the entire civil society community that was leading peaceful protests on the streets of Damascus and its working class suburbs and Homs and Daraa and cities all over Syria. The people that are like your children and grandchildren, who were university students, who were doctors, who were pharmacists, who were, you know, thinking people. And many of those leaders ended up becoming leaders of the hardcore rebel groups. So while that was happening, what was happening in the rest of the world? The US was doing the opposite of what Teddy Roosevelt suggested, speaking loudly and carrying a small stick. There were many statements about how Assad has lost legitimacy, Assad should go, and the power of words. I mean, even in today's cynical world, where in the Middle East there's a lot of legitimate criticism of the United States, deep down people really respond to the American ideas of freedom, democracy, and believed that there would be some kind of at least political, if not military, help from America. And I know dozens, maybe hundreds of Syrians personally, and outside the ones I know personally, there are thousands of people who staked their lives and everything they had on the proposition that if they simply gathered information, they became citizen journalists, they became photographers and videographers with their cell phones, that if they recorded what was happening to them, to their neighborhoods, the beatings, the massacres, the shelling, the children being killed in every way you can imagine, and they got that information out to the free press of a wider world. Beyond that, their ideas were not sophisticated. They didn't know what they thought specifically was going to happen, but they thought something would happen to stop this. And it was a losing bet. I was one of the journalists standing there holding this funnel that took in all that information and tried to make it into a pipeline for the world to read, and I think we did the best we could. But the context in the world was not such that anything was going to happen. The UN Security Council is deadlocked, Russia and America vetoing each other's propositions. We had also set the stage for this with Iraq. So Thanasi and I spent years living in Iraq, and I've seen with my own eyes the disaster of US policy in Iraq. So with a bad faith invasion of Iraq, the US had lost its credibility to lead when the Arab revolts happened, to say, yes, with a straight face, we stand for freedom, justice, democracy in the world. We've cried wolf about that too many times. There is no political support in in America for that. There's maybe no bandwidth given the ongoing military commitments there and in Afghanistan. The U.S. Invasion brought jihadis to Iraq, created al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had not existed before, and became ISIS, you know, calved off ISIS as a subsidiary that then became a rival. And when ISIS went to Iraq in 2014 and grabbed all those U.S. tanks that we had given to a rickety Iraqi military, that's how they were able to take over much of Iraq and Syria. So into that vacuum came ISIS. And again, it was a huge boon for Assad. Now he really was fighting terrorism. He brought in Russia and, you know, sort of blurring the details, Russia mostly bombed the rebel groups that were not ISIS and often had fought ISIS. So Russia bombed them, whereas America bombed the terrorists for Assad. I have to back up and say, yes, there was American support. There was a $1 billion CIA program supporting certain rebel groups. It was part of an incoherent US policy that seemed to have different policies running out of the Pentagon, the State Department, the CIA, and the White House, respectively. And it was effective when it wanted to be. But it came in late after the US had already allowed our so-called allies in the Gulf to divide and turn rebel groups into rivals of each other and proxies of theirs. It was a bit too late to make that cohere again. And it was and the US funding was often used more as a brake than as a gas pedal for the insurgency, making sure that weapons were doled out in a very judicious way so that they could go as far as we wanted them to, but not farther. And the idea was to push Assad to the negotiating table, not to win. And the flaw in this is that Assad was never going to go to the negotiating table and never will. It's completely anathema to the way he and his inner circle run things. So again, what we did was enough to stir things up and raise the level of violence and eventually bring Russia into the conflict, but not enough to really have any positive effect. So now that I've cheered you up a lot, I'll just ask, why shouldn't we just wash our hands of this? Why shouldn't we just say, well, that's really another mess in the Middle East, let's forget about it? And I did hear that from people in both administrations and in the expert foreign policy community that Syria is containable. We'll just let it be containable. Well, that's patently not true. There's now five million refugees outside the country. Some million of them have gone to Europe. And the refugee crisis has ended up being a driver for so many other problems in the world. Syria didn't create all these problems. They pre-existed the crisis. These global problems made the response to Syria perhaps doomed, but certainly not good. And then in turn, Syria, there's this feedback loop where Syria then made these problems worse. And I'll explain what I mean. There was already, as I said, a dehumanization of people from the region. There was an overweighting of terrorism because it's spectacular, because it fits into our fears, because terrorist groups like ISIS on purpose want to grab disproportionate attention for themselves. When refugees started going to Europe, people in their minds conflate the refugees with what they're fleeing from. Those refugees are fleeing from Assad's brutality and from ISIS's brutality. They are not terrorists. But that's the impression that people have. They just mix it all together and they call it people from over there. This was in turn ridden like a parade by the right wing in Europe to stoke fears about diversifying populations, about the meaning of the European Union, about religion, changes in society. And even in America, so this definitely helped bring us electoral victories by the far right in Europe. And arguably, even it helped us bring us Trump, which makes no sense because even under Obama, America wasn't letting many refugees in. But in people's minds, and he drove this, you know, he talked about refugees and terrorists coming from Mexico, from here, from there. And somehow the facts didn't really matter. It just became a thing for people to be afraid of. David Duke would tweet praise of Assad, would tweet praise of Putin, as if now this liberal front that's fighting terrorism is also somehow a representative of white supremacy and identity, and that's become a very common thing online. And on top of this, the humanitarian systems that were created, the political and humanitarian systems that were created internationally after World War II to mitigate the worst of war, didn't function when it came to Syria. They were overwhelmed. There was not a consensus about how to operate humanitarian aid in a country like Syria, which under the UN system has the right to exercise sovereign control over aid given inside its borders. But what happens when that government is using aid as a weapon? Is using aid to support its army? Is using the withholding of aid to get people to come in and give their names to the secret police or to besiege people in a surrounded rebel-held area? So the UN had no answers for this kind of thing. And the one thing I can say to bring a little bit of light to this picture is that the Syrians who I've gotten to know throughout these many years, like I said, they've lost everything except their ideas and their resilience and their commitment to ideals that they feel they've seen abandoned by the rest of the world. So people who managed to survive with their health and with their sanity, or even with those things partially damaged, but they're still walking, they're working on ways to continue to help their country. They're working on ways to help Syrians that are in the diaspora. They're producing art and movies and documentaries and journalism to let the world know what's happening. And they feel actually even more committed to these ideals. Yes, they feel that they had to give up for the time being on what's happening in Syria, and they had to find other channels. So one of the people who worked with me had been in prison for a year and a half, had been through every kind of torture. He came out, and what was his crime? He had been a protester, and then he had delivered medical supplies to injured protesters, which was literally considered terrorism under Syria's law. He gave up activism, he became a journalist, he worked with me for a couple years. He ended up going and getting asylum in France, where he makes videos for Doctors Without Borders, goes all over the world to Bangladesh, Iraq, Sudan, and is telling the stories of other refugees like him and using his experience and the trust he can get with them to bring that forward. Now, it's very traumatic for him to keep working on traumatic subjects, and so he goes through ups and downs. But he's just one of the thousands and thousands of Syrians that are now in Europe or are keeping their heads down in Syria or in Turkey or in Lebanon or Jordan, who remain committed to these ideas. Now, of course, there's plenty of people who were just caught up in this and are just trying to survive, and they're not working on this kind of stuff. But I'm talking about the really intelligent people from many different classes, but who had a real idea behind what they were doing. They're in touch with people from other countries through the online networks that exist today. Some of them have supported the Black Lives Matter movement in Ferguson, giving advice on how to keep protesting even when you've been tear gassed. Many kinds of you know, ways of trying to push these ideas forward in the world. It's not much to leave you with, but I do think it's important to keep listening to these people. Mazen Darwish, who is a Syrian human rights lawyer, who had been through many rounds of torture, said in the beginning years of the revolt, and Len, he was one of many Syrians who said this to me, that if these atrocities are allowed to continue with total impunity in Syria, it will threaten freedom in the West. It sounded very histrionic to me at the time, and I heard it from many people, and I said, okay, I understand why the Syrians are riled up and why they would say this, but of course it's an exaggeration. Well, a member of the European Parliament recently got back to Mazen and apologized for not taking him seriously back then. And I also no longer think that Mazen is exaggerating. Mazen is one of these resilient Syrians. He is working with European lawyers in Berlin, France, Vienna, and Sweden, and elsewhere to build human rights cases under European laws that allow prosecution for war crimes that have happened elsewhere. As long as there's a victim or a perpetrator who's in that their country in Europe, they can actually start cases. Short of the International Criminal Court or a Nuremberg-style trial for Syria or a truth and reconciliation process like in South Africa, none of which are structurally possible in Syria right now, what we have is people like Mazen trying to document and seek accountability in whatever forum they have so that we know the facts, we don't forget them, and we don't forget the implications. So let's support them.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Anne Bernard speaking on current events in Syria. She will now answer questions from the audience.
Anne, we want to thank you very much. Not quite as uplifting as I might have hoped, but no, I think a very accurate representation of what's going on. What I usually do, and what I'm going to do now, is while people are collecting questions, I'm going to take the prerogative of the moderator and ask one of my own. I've always thought that our views of what was going to happen as a consequence of these uprisings in the Arab world, including, you know, referring to it as the Arab Spring, was a little overly optimistic. What do you think, have we learned any lessons about how to react to these type of uprisings and what in the future, because they're going to happen again.
I think it's a great question, and I think, you know, it's like, you know, what do you think of the French Revolution? It's not over yet. So I think I never chose to call it the Arab Spring. I called it Arab Revolts because that was more descriptive. And I think absolutely one thing that we've learned is that things are not going to go the same in every country. We learned that, you know, as I said in my talk, there are consequences when the U.S. just throws out words without really having thought through the strategy behind them. We saw that in two critical cases in Syria. First, in the calling for Assad must go and Assad has lost legitimacy. And then, of course, the red line that Obama said that if there were chemical weapons used, there would be consequences. And I think the decision not to deliver even a symbolic, or as John Kerry once said, an incredibly tiny and small, you know, response, even not delivering that, was certainly a signal to Assad and possibly to Russia that it could go ahead into Ukraine and that, you know, that the U.S. was not going to stand by its words. You know, does that lead us to say that the next time, this is a very interesting question that I just had an interesting talk with someone from the Obama administration about. Does this mean that next time, if we are not prepared to physically support the overthrow of someone, that we should just shut up when there is a revolt against that person? I don't think it has to mean that, because words do matter, and it still matters to ask for accountability for Assad's crimes. When we talk about that, it has incremental effects. So I think it's just more important to calibrate and to think through, you know, the second, third, and fourth order possibilities after we do or say something, or choose not to do or say something, because choosing not to is also a choice.
Always. Thank you very much. Here's one I found very interesting in glancing through these here to start with. What does Assad want? Does he want to rebuild his country? Does he want simply have power? I mean, why is he struggling so much?
You know, I'm one of the people who started out with a much more open, forgiving mind towards Assad than I later ended up with. Certainly, I covered Syria during the earlier years of his rule before the revolts. I first visited Syria in 2001, and it was still in the middle of what was called the Damascus Spring, where there was a small political opening, which later turned out to be a complete mirage, and everybody who tried to have sort of salons or conversations or discussions or independent protests about everything was jailed and tortured. But at that time, people thought maybe there's a chance here he's going to reform, he's going to be different from his father. And then there was the struggle over power in Lebanon that forced Syria ultimately to step back from its de facto military occupation of Lebanon. So I understood things in terms of Syria having its Machiavellian interests, which a nation is entitled to have. And I saw things through this prism, and I was giving more of the benefit of the doubt to Assad. But what I've learned from watching this war unfold, from speaking to insiders that are close to his regime, and from reading a fantastic book that you should all read by a colleague of mine, Sam Dagher, D-A-G-E-R. It's called Assad or We Burn the Country. It's a very convincing account of what was happening inside the palace. I think Assad from day one had no intention of any reform and believed that believed essentially the same racist idea that some in the West have about Syrians, which is that they should just be ruled by force. And that every step that happened in the escalation against the protesters was known about and approved by him. And it's hard not to come to the conclusion that what he wants is just to maintain power and wealth at all costs. It's about money. It's about the family milking Syria and milking what was called the capitalist reforms of Syria just for their own benefit. And no, I don't think he cares about rebuilding the country. I hope so. Hope I'm wrong.
Well, this simple follow-up, and maybe you've answered it already, but maybe you could elaborate. Can he put Syria back together again? I mean, it's so fractionated at this point that, yes, a strong arm, but...
Yeah, I think what we're going to have is a freeze. It's going to be frozen in time. It's going to be frozen politically by force, as long as Russia chooses to support that. And Russia, I believe, will support that through 2021 when Assad will be reelected in a, you know, not real election, and will serve until 2028. And by then, Russia will be able to say, we won. In the meta struggle that Russia is trying to win is to show that the United States and others cannot support democracy movements in a country against the will of its government, because Russia doesn't want to ever be that country. So Russia, I think, can declare victory about that round about 2028. But I don't think that during those years Assad will be able to put the country back together. Again, I wish, but I don't know where the money's going to come from unless Europe decides to split from what's currently U.S. policy and decides, because there is some pressure within Europe, let's make the money we would make by being the companies that would go in and rebuild everything in Syria. But right now, I don't see that happening.
So let's then switch to kind of the broader impact of Syria for a minute, if we could. Have the Israelis played in the Syrian conflict, and what is the effect in the broader Middle East context of what's going on in Syria?
Okay, this is
two different questions. But.
Well, these are great and related questions. According to Assad's rhetoric, of course, Israel and its American allies fomented the uprising against Assad because, in revenge for his supposed support of the Palestinian cause and resistance against Israel. And in fact, the truth is the opposite. Palestinians born in Syria were among the leaders of the revolt against Assad because Syria did treat Palestinians better than other countries. They really felt that they had a stake in Syrian society, and they really consider themselves Syrians, Syrian Palestinians. They have everything except citizenship. They can go to university, they can have health care, they have all these things that Palestinians don't have in Lebanon, for instance. So first of all, many Palestinians were with the uprising, and both Israel and the United States ultimately did not want to see Assad fall because he was the devil they know. They were concerned about vacuum and chaos, and They do also want to contain Iran. So they're all about containment and calibration, I believe. Israel did intervene quite a lot and with total impunity, using its air force to strike Hezbollah and other Iranian-backed groups inside Syria when they were moving troops or weapons, or if they were concerned that some weapons were going to be moved to Lebanon to strengthen Hezbollah in Lebanon. So in terms of the larger context, again, what the U.S. and Israel are both concerned about is the vastly increased influence of Iran inside Syria. When the Iranian Revolution happened, it was Syria that was the patron of the new Iranian government. That role has been definitively reversed. It was already going that way, but certainly Syria, in a way, is now a client state of Iran and Russia. And that is very significant for Iran's hold on the region and on Lebanon, and allows Iranian-affiliated groups to be right up to the Golan border boundary line with Israel. So, and again, what we've had in Iraq is another round of the strengthening of the relationship between Iran and the Iraqi military. In a strange turn of events, U.S. military advisors were basically advising the same Iraqis that the Iranians were advising in the fight against ISIS inside Iraq, and quite successfully too, actually. Oh, and I forgot to say that, yes, so also we've supercharged the rivalries between Saudi Arabia and Qatar and their respective allies. So because Syria became a battleground for that and intensified the Saudi-Iranian clash throughout the region.
Yes, you've talked a lot about the exiles fleeing Syria. Is there any evidence of a viable government in exile? Is there a group that's forming to try to counter this at some point in time?
No, I mean, there was an attempt to create such a group by the U.S. and other countries that generally supported the uprising, and it's quite embarrassing. This exile government was actually recognized by the U.S. and many other countries as the legitimate representative of the Syrian people, but that's quietly no longer talked about. I mean, they were divided. They didn't have support on the ground. Instantly, as soon as the whole thing was formed, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, UAE, and others worked to adopt and own different representatives within that government so that it never was anything other than a battleground for proxy competition between those U.S. allies. The U.S., that was I'm not saying the U.S. would have done it better, because we haven't always done it better, but the U.S. certainly ceded its ability to shape that by leading from behind.
Well, there are a number of questions here related to essentially the same thing, and that is, what could or should the U.S. have done at the beginning of this conflict that would have changed the outcome, if anything?
It's a tough question. I mean, it's all hindsight. You know, it's hard to prescribe, and I am, as a journalist, it's not my role to make very specific policy recommendations, but I will say that as this Obama official said to me recently, it's hard to argue that we did it right, because it's difficult to imagine a worse outcome. So nobody can stand here and defend, you know, what we did do or what we didn't do, the combination of doing and not doing. So I can just make some observations. You know, I can say that at the beginning, there was an over-reliance in policy circles on the idea that Assad just couldn't make it, that since all the other dictators had seemed to fall, so would he. And there wasn't an adequate attention to the ways in which the Syrian regime was different, was more brutal, was more specifically built to be coup-proof, and how far it was likely to go in violence. So that was not well assessed. And from that flowed a lot of decisions, like the idea that we didn't have to do much to get the outcome we wanted. I think, again, and we haven't even talked about Northeast Syria and the SDF and the Kurds and the Turks. And one thing as an observer I've seen is that there is a consistent failure to match policy goals with the strategic and tactical plans put into place to achieve those goals. There's a mismatch that we've seen again and again since 9/11.
So just to clarify, maybe, when you talk about previous administrations, did all this start with the Obama administration, or did it go back to Bush, or earlier, or?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by all this.
Well,
I mean, certainly the Arab
revolts.
That wasn't
part of the question.
The Arab revolts began under Obama, and Obama was supposed to be resetting our whole relationship with the region. But what we know now about Obama is that actually he wanted to pivot to Asia, and he did have, in my opinion, from reading the Jeffrey Goldberg interview in The Atlantic, he had a bit of a prejudiced view towards Arabs and the Arab world. I'm sorry to say, you know. And I don't know how much leverage he was ever going to put into it. And again, I think it's silly to say that conflicts in the Middle East are containable. Since when have we seen that in history? But no, of course it didn't start with Obama. As I described in my talk, the original sin of the entire situation in the Middle East right now is the Iraq invasion and other wrong responses to 9/11. We did everything that Osama bin Laden could have dreamed of for us to do in response to 9/11. And we could go back further than George W. Bush, but that's a good example.
That's far enough. Okay, thank you very much. We talk a little bit about the effect on the region. Could you comment on the strategic value of Syria to Russia and whether Russia has really gained out of all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do believe that Russia has legitimate interests in Syria that I can't blame it for pursuing. Russia has a very long-standing relationship with Syria, going back decades. When I would meet senior Syrian government officials, they would speak to me in Russian, and they would get this misty, cheerful look of remembering their student days in Moscow. And those are real relationships. There are tens of thousands of marriages between Russians and Syrians. There are lots of Russian businesses that have been there for a long time. And it makes perfect sense for Russia to want to return its footprint to the Mediterranean and to reestablish its sort of business and military relationships with Syria. Now, has it gained overall? I think absolutely yes. I think it gained more through the U.S. Strategic fecklessness than it did through any specific territorial gain in Syria. I think the stepping away from the red line, I didn't even talk about information wars. Syria was an amazing proving ground for the Russian troll farms, which are people employed to put out misinformation on social media, and lots of Americans then retweet them and get influenced by them. And we now know that some of the same accounts that put out lies about what's happening on the ground in Syria are the same ones that are tweeting divisive messages about US politics internally and are involved in spreading the WikiLeaks stuff that was supposed to be used to help Trump win. So it's all connected. Russia really gained an amazing proving ground for its information warfare strategies, not to mention for weapons that it tested in Syria, not to mention for showing that the U.S., that Russia was a much better ally to its allies, a much more reliable and effective ally on the ground in Syria than the U.S. was to the ones it was supposedly supporting.
I have a huge number of questions here about... and this is, the most direct and straightforward of all of them. What role have ethnic and religious divisions played in the ferocity of the civil war?
They've played a really big role, and I would never like to reduce the war to this. So I think there's a nuanced way to answer the question. So absolutely, there was pre-existing ethnic and sectarian tensions within Syria. It's a minority government led by the Assad family, which is Alawite. They haven't done a lot to benefit all Alawites as a group, but they did create a situation where Alawites, who had been a very poor and oppressed group that were basically serfs in the past, did have a pathway to advancement by joining the military. So the military is disproportionately Alawite. The government has supported and fomented the pre-existing clashes and tensions in order to make Alawites certain that Sunnis will harm them if given the chance, and to give Sunnis reason to be resentful of Alawites through the discrimination that they always practice. So of course, that doesn't absolve the Syrians themselves, who went along with such divisions and fomented them in their own mosques or churches or Alawite communities. But I will say that there are plenty of Syrians who are not like that, that the original civil uprising had a big participation from Christian youth, especially before violence came into it, that, you know, being Christian or being Alawite is no defense against being disappeared by the government's secret services. If you go against the government's wishes or speak against the government, you'll be disappeared just like a Sunni. So in that sense, it's non-sectarian. And what happened was that as the conflict became more and more violent, there was more and more opening for extremists on both sides to say, you see, those people are out to kill you. And it has become increasingly a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Let me do one follow-up on that, another related question. Do the Christian church leaders in Syria still tend to support Assad to offset the threat from extreme Muslims?
Yes, there is. Again, part of this is trumped up, and part of it is reality. Okay, so yes, absolutely. At the beginning, Christian leaders, some of them, tried to stay neutral. Some of them were always vocally with Assad. Some of them tried very hard to stay neutral. By the time things had evolved to the point where most of the rebel groups controlling territory were quite sectarian and were, at least influenced by extremists, most Christians decided that that we'd rather stick with the devil we know, including people that had initially supported the uprising. But I still think we have to keep in mind the context in which, a different response earlier to the legitimate desires of Syrian people would have headed off this kind of development. The government has tried very hard to emphasize its role as a protector of minorities, but again, its protection has not been all that effective.
Now, there's a number of questions that kind of surprised me because I hadn't thought about it, but it's on climate change, and I think people heard the fact that you're going to move on to study that problem. But it's, how is Syria feeding its people with the drought? What role did climate change play in the crisis? And just what is the role of climate there in Syria?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is a matter of debate among scholars, and I do not have enough expertise in this subject to come down on one side or the other of the debate about how much of a factor climate change was in setting the table for this uprising. For sure, there were years of drought in the 2000s, which pushed more and more poor rural Syrians into the makeshift suburbs surrounding the big cities, and creating the dense populations that later rose up in protests and created the economic strains and inequalities, just as capitalist reform started to allow the people around Assad to get super wealthy. There were these people struggling with the collapse of agriculture in some areas. So whether that drought is specifically attributable to climate change, I actually don't know. But I think, yes, it is the type of conflict that we can envision becoming very much affected by climate change in the future.
Thank you. And you'll learn more, of course, from your new assignment.
Yeah, ask me in a year.
We'll ask you a year from now. That's correct. We're starting to run out of time, and we always have more questions than we have time for, but I wanted to get in a couple that were of a more personal note. One question is, what do you think that you saw or heard in Syria that most affected you and shaped your mindset on these issues?
Well, from long before Syria, I really did believe that it's important to de-otherize whoever is being painted as the other of the moment. And I that's what drove my interest in learning Russian as a teenager in the Cold War. But I certainly have learned the value of that in covering Syria and the Arab revolts, because the more you're used to people and their culture and the more you work directly with journalists on the ground from those places that you're covering, the more you are able yourself as a journalist and in turn to convey to your readers that these are people just like you, and to see conflicts through those lenses, that you can really think of it in terms of what would I do if I were in that situation. It's quite similar to what some of these people are doing. And then I certainly have become very much attuned to the brunt that's borne by civilians in conflict. And when I started covering these conflicts, I wasn't a parent, and I was a parent throughout covering Syria. So I definitely have seen enough of the bad stuff that happens to children to really question any kind of military actions that are done without trying to minimize the harm to civilians. Because when we look at what, of course, international law already stipulates that, but it's not really something that governments tend to take into account, and I think it should be taken into account.
Well, I thank you very, very much. I think we've got a more of an understanding of just the difficulties.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Anne Bernard, a New York Times journalist. She recently spoke with the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations on Whither Syria and Where Is It Taking Us? If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.